Good morning, everybody. Today is Friday, August 19th, 2016. And this is Before the First Cup of Tools here on UCY.TV. Happy Friday, everyone. It is 76 degrees, humid and sunny here in upstate New York. Think it's going to be a baker this weekend. So also, happy 4th anniversary to UCY.TV. August 19th, 2012 is when we first went live. So this is quite a milestone, 4 years, and who would have thought we'd still be here? So where do we leave off yesterday? We titled the show Li-Fi Brain Scanning, Military Microbial and DNA Creations. And yeah, we talked about some pretty insane stuff this week, not only involving robotics, if you remember, Sophia, Skynet, the Internet of Things, bioenhancement, and commercializing brain implants, light bulbs that can scan your brain, and brain prints that are as accurate as a fingerprint, and then DARPA and the Naval Mad Science Department, and all the universities and hospitals all involved in synthetic biology and being able to find ways to enslave what nature created and make it do what it wants it to do, to be able to copy what nature created and usurp those technologies for their own benefit. And we keep finding over and over again it's being financed by the war machine, by the Department of Defense, and the Department of Defense is pulling the tech titans right under its wings. And we are seeing a pretty scary future. And, you know, when we started reading about genetically modified soil bacteria that can be modified to be electrical wires in the soil by the Office of Naval Research's Warfare Division, what does that mean? We found out that DARPA and the DARPA lady have been talking about utilizing synthetic biology to be able to terraform Mars and to be able to fix unfixable places, polluted places on planet Earth before we ever got to Mars. We have companies such as Halliburton that, and good old Dickie Cheney, you know, everything comes back to that whole cabal with Dickie Cheney. If anybody saw the UCY 4th anniversary card today, Dickie Cheney is singing us a happy birthday song. And I thought that was appropriate because, you know, yesterday I was talking about the Gulf and synthetic bacteria and some of the rumors and some of the things that they found like years later, bacteria that just munch up oil. I'm sure that there's stuff that naturally occurs, but it doesn't mean that there weren't some experiments done and things let go. You know, at one point I dug into Halliburton and there was a facility, I'm trying to remember, it was in Texas, I believe, northern Texas, and that whole area got hit by a big tornado and it wiped it all clean. When I started looking into what was in that area, I found that there had been a Halliburton facility there where they'd been doing research on some unmentionable things, but it was some synthetic biology that was happening there. And there was never a word about it really in the mainstream news, but I had found something in the local paper. And, you know, then things happen and I kind of forgot about it. But, you know, when I put that together with the Gulf, of course, that facility was in Texas, and Dick Cheney, the oil drilling, the oil cleanup, some of the things that I've heard if someone remembers her name, tell me. She used to be on Orion with us. But it wasn't Dr. Carpenter. It was Dr. I don't know. But anyway, she was one of the only people that I knew back at that time who knew anything about DARPA or anything about synthetic biology. And she and I had a few really good conversations. We had her on once on an interview. And she had talked all about things that were going on in secret labs, genetically modifying people and doing weird shit, throwing rabies virus packets out into wildlife preserves, which now, you know, has become commonplace. But that virus being tossed out there, and that was something that they apparently had been messing with for a long time as part of the vaccines. And I know that for a fact. I mean, I looked into the rabies vaccine because that caused that induced sarcoma in the bone. But anyway, to get back to synthetic biology, there's a very long history in a lot of things that have been happening here, except we have now come to a crescendo where every genie is out of the bottle. Now, we have the Department of Energy submitting synthetic biology reports to Congress. You could look it up, synthetic biology report. Congress for 2013. There was also a House bill for forwarding that, and I think they actually spun that into another division now, and that's another whole day's show that we can go down that rabbit hole later. But as we find out then yesterday, DARPA is awarding $32 million to the Broad Institute for MIT and Harvard for DNA design and manufacturing. Now, remember that this whole Broad Institute, MIT, and Harvard were involved in that synthetic human genome project as well. DARPA, of course, being interested in the Super Soldier project for a very long time. You could search that also. And then they also mentioned in this story about the Living Foundries project, 1,000 molecules, and that was to be able to make life in reusable little pieces that can be snapped together and, like the DARPA lady said in that terraforming story, create life on demand with features and functionalities from across the board. Once they get all of the DNA in a database for each of the different genus and species and phyla and whatever else is out there, and they can index them all. And remember, they're doing DNA barcoding also, and barcoding is the key. I was involved in a barcoding project back in 1993, if you can believe it. My very, very, very first computer job. And we barcoded hundreds of thousands of commercial collateral files at I worked at a, operations center for a bank. It was a job right out of college. Got in there through a temp agency, and then they hired me permanently, and then I happened to be the only one that knew anything really about computers, and they had just upgraded to this whole network that no one knew anything about, so that's how it all started. But we started this barcoding program, and I worked with the developer. He programmed from scratch using an Access database, and I did all of his beta testing and helped him build the user interface, and we got it all working. But what we would do is we would scan location. You'd scan the file label that had all the database input, had a barcode on it, and then you'd scan your location where you're going to put it. Well, guys, that's what they're doing to us. That's what the Internet of Things is, giving us a location, a designation, and a number. Right. So now we have, let's tie this now to some of the other stuff that's going on in economics, because I was thinking about this. I mean, these are all parts of this big puzzle. We have IBM, and I'd mentioned this this week or last week, but we've talked about this many times before. The Universal ID program that Brandon Turville had written about that was rolled out in India, and apparently we just saw a story not too long ago that was updated pretty recently. Brandon's story is from 2012, that they were still working on rollout, but they are going for 1.2 billion people to be on this electronic ID program using biometrics, doling out funds, acting as their quote unquote official identity. So here we now have, fast forward, move geographically now to like these Davos forums. If anyone caught the rebrew yesterday for this show, I had 13 minutes of dead air yesterday morning, so I had to make that up somehow. And I played part of the 2016 Davos forum that had happened this year, looking at the future. And they were talking about, amazingly, all the topics that we cover pretty much on this show. And one of the things they had mentioned is being used for good or evil. Moving into the internet of things and how wonderful technology is, because it's bringing us all together into this global framework. And of course, we can monitor everything. We can remotely sense everything. And one of the things that all of this technology is creating is, instead of bringing us closer together, and this was the Indian guy that had talked, they had four people, I believe, on the panel that were all in different industries. Well, they were all in the tech industry, but from different perspectives. And he had said a couple of interesting things. One of the things that we've lost completely is empathy. And it's interesting because we've discussed many times before that whole dopamine dangling carrot addiction to the machine that is proven by biology. I mean, we've read many studies now that have shown that. We've also read that dopamine addiction, they found in brain scans, is something that the psychopathic personality disorder shares with. People have become addicted to video games or addicted to gambling or addicted to sex or addicted to high fructose corn syrup in their food or addicted to many other things that cause that same brain response. So when they end up with a psychopathic personality disorder, one of the big symptoms is a loss of empathy. And I really think that that is a lot. I mean, that's Dr. Simon's whole premise of his show, Character Matters, on Sundays at 7 p.m. Eastern. He's live just about every week. And Dr. Simon's whole premise is about how we've lost this whole humanity. And a lot of this psychopathy that's being formed is society induced. And I really think it comes down to this dopamine addiction. So in this Davos forum that I played the clip from yesterday in the archives, you can catch it if you missed it. It's at the end. It talked about losing empathy and how if the world is to move forward with automation and AI and remote sensing and remote communications, we need to form empathy back again. Well, there was a story that came out. I think we're going to go down this path today. Cognitive offloading. Now, we've talked about a few different things. There was a study from Microsoft that came out about the human attention span back about 10, 15 years ago when I had actually taken a class on adult concepts of adult learning. I was doing my technical training stuff. We had learned that the adult attention span was about 8 minutes, which coincidentally was the time between commercials on TV. Well, then Microsoft came out with a study last year that found it was only 8 seconds now, which was about the time between getting messages or being interrupted. Well, there's a new story that came out, cognitive offloading, how the internet is increasingly taking over human memory. And if there ever was a sign and symptom that we are being sucked into the machine, Kurzweil's cloud, you know, we always thought we were going to one day just push a button and be uploaded to the cloud. And maybe someday in the future that'll be true with all these little micro smart dust implants that they have now that can run on piezoelectric power. I mean, with the insanity of all this, with 802.11 wireless connectivity, 24/7 connecting to your light bulbs and being sent to the cloud in some big DNA data storage center. I mean, it's just not even comprehensible what our future looks like at the moment. And that really is what that whole Davis Forum was about. If you have a chance to watch that whole entire hour, I highly recommend it. I think I linked to it. If you go to UCY's YouTube, youtube.com/UCYTV, and just go to the main homepage of the channel, down under the liked items, I have a liked list there, and that's all the stuff I want you guys to see. I'll like it because it's something that's, you know, plausible, something that you should watch, but it's right there. It should be the last one. Anyway, cognitive offloading on the internet is increasingly taking over your human memory, so we're not going to be push a button, suck us into the machine. It's going to happen slowly as we're being devoured, we're being assimilated, and as we depend depend more and more upon Google, doing a Google, Google searching. I actually heard someone say that. I went and got a haircut yesterday, got a good 4 inches chopped off, and I feel human again. So that was good. But I heard some woman in the salon yesterday saying something, and she's like, oh, I don't know. Well, I Googled it, and it wasn't there, so it must not exist. And I thought to myself, well, yeah, that means you probably did one search with one term. And I'm sure that that does not mean if you gave me 5 minutes, I could find it. But, you know, people depend so much on the internet that they don't use their brains. You know, it's the old oracle, the oracle of technology. And as we interact more and more with the machine and the devices become more and more invasive into our lives on a daily basis, you know, someday with this universal ID, we'll be waving our hand as part of the Internet of Things while we have our little microchip in our hand, the size of a smart dust mote. That's what they said. To be our magic powers, like Regina Duggan talked about. Anyway, so let's read about being sucked into the machine. Our increasing reliance on the internet and the ease of access to the vast resource available online is affecting our thought processes for problem solving, recall, and learning. Ding, ding, ding. And you know, what's so amazing about all of this is that all of those cognitive functions that we used to have as a society, those problem-solving skills, those recalling skills, and those learning skills, all existed before the advent of the internet, the advent of this being sucked into the machine, this advent of being addicted to this technology and this manipulation of our brain chemicals to make us want it so bad. And you know, they've been doing research since at least the early 1900s on psychology and cognitive function and how to manipulate those push buttons. I'm almost thinking that this is an evil takeover. This, think about how insane this is. This will completely allow them to rule every DNA strand on the planet. We have millions of dollars from DARPA going into the Broad Institute, MIT, and Harvard to create and manufacture synthetic DNA. And they announced that they were going to create the synthetic human genome. Guys, this is bad news. I don't know. Like, this is a mass realization on our fourth anniversary. I almost did a picture of Dick Cheney standing with the World Trade Center and the whole world on fire behind him, but I didn't. Anyway, in a new article, researchers have found that cognitive offloading, quote unquote, or the tendency to rely on things like the internet as an aid memoir, or hey, your future augmented chip implant, your reliance to rely on the internet as an aid increases after each use. You get more addicted every single time you touch the machine. And you know, I found that in my own research at home. If I get my daughter, if I pull her off and get her off the junkie box, and all junkie boxes, no TV, no computer, that's it. For just a day, totally different kid. But if I give her even 5 minutes on either one of them, it like pushes this button. It's a totally different personality. I'm telling you, there's definitely something to it. So anyway, all right, I'm going to stop rambling. 20 minutes already rambling. Let's get into the story. Our increasing reliance on the internet and the ease of access to the vast resources available online is affecting our thought processes for problem solving, recall, and learning. In a new article published in the journal Memory, Researchers at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, have found that cognitive offloading, or a tendency to rely on things like the internet, increases after each use. We might think that memory is something that happens in the head, but increasingly, it is becoming something that happens with the help of agents, ding, again that word, outside of our head. I'm telling you, it's just like an antivirus where it goes and you have agents that you assign to do things, to scan. Benjamin Storm, Sean Stone, and Aaron Benjamin conducted experiments to determine our likelihood to reach for a computer or smartphone to answer questions. And participants were first divided into two groups to answer some challenging trivia questions. One group used just their memory, and the other used Google. Participants were given the option of answering subsequent easier questions by the method of their choice. And the results revealed that participants who previously used the internet to gain information were significantly more likely to revert to Google for subsequent questions than those who had relied on memory. Participants also spent less time consulting their own memory before reaching for the internet, and they were not only more likely to do it again, but they were likely to do it much more quickly. So good little mousie, all it takes is one or two times and you're well practiced. Remarkably, 30% of the participants who previously consulted the internet failed to attempt to answer a single simple question from memory. Oh, so it makes you lazier than shit, too. How insane is that? Google is not evil. Remember, that was their original tagline. Wow. Lead author Dr. Benjamin Storm commented, quote, memory is changing. Our research shows that when we use the internet to support and extend our memory, we become more reliant on it. Now, you know, we've heard Kurzweil talking all about extending your memory into the cloud and how amazing that is. And he was the director and is the director in charge of that deep learning and being able to scan text and make it understandable by the context around it and all kinds of different mind and brain experiments. Seems quite interesting to me that the more you use Google tools, the more you require the use of them as a dangling carrot. It says, remarkably, 30% of participants, yes, didn't even answer a single question from memory. They said, our memory is changing. Our research shows that we use the internet to support and extend our memory, and then we become more reliant on it. Whereas before, we might have tried to recall something on our own. Now we don't bother. The extinction of a species. That's what I call it. Isn't our higher thinking skills what made us dominant to all other animals? As more information becomes available via smartphones and other devices, we become progressively more reliant on it in our daily lives. This research that uses a certain method for fact-finding has a marked influence on the probability of future repeat behavior. And, you know, as we read about the truth algorithm and things of that nature, where Google can actually groom what search results end up at the top, people are too damn lazy to even think of it for themselves. So what's going to make them scroll down two pages to maybe find your story that didn't make top hitting? So as Google then grooms results even more to paid subscribers, as well as to truth scanned pages, how difficult or how easy is it going to be for Google to be the reality provider to the masses, to be able to sway public opinion in any way that they see fit? And as they are integrated into things since that new Defense Department board, as well as positions in the federal government and former staffers working for the Clinton campaign and Googlers going to DARPA or DARPers going to Google, it's got to really make you, if nothing else, if this is all tinfoil hat wearing lunacy, it's got to make you at least raise a Spock eyebrow. You have to say. All right, let's continue because we got a deep dive. There's a deep dive coming. This research suggests that a certain method for fact-finding has marked influence on probability of future repeat behavior. Time will tell if this pattern will have any further reaching impacts on human memory than has our reliance on other information sources. Certainly, the internet is more comprehensive, dependable, and on the whole faster than the imperfections of human memory. Imperfections, you imperfect human. Borne out by the more accurate answers from participants on the internet condition during this research. With a world of information, a Google search away, and a smartphone, the need to remember trivial facts, figures, and numbers is inevitably becoming less necessary to function in everyday life. Yes, all those trivial facts, like how to start a fire from nature, how to hunt, how to build, how to engineer things, how to be a MacGyver. Gotta tell you, if you haven't watched MacGyver repeats, MacGyver had to be one of my all-time favorite shows growing up. My dad's a MacGyver. He could fix anything with a piece of chewing gum and a paperclip. MacGyver is worth watching. I'm sure you can find him out there somewhere. But, you know, we are losing, quote, function in everyday life. And as we're losing our higher functioning thinking skills, we have artificial intelligence and automation coming down the road very quickly, we've discovered. We're going to become an extinct species in the not too distant future. There's a story that came out in Motherboard a couple days ago. If schools don't change, robots will bring on a, quote, permanent underclass, unquote. Robots are taking all the jobs, but are we, the average, moderately skilled human, screwed, or aren't we? Well, let me just get that out of the way now. This is from the author. We are, unless there are drastic, immediate changes to education and economic systems around the world. Ding, ding, ding. Now, we found out just recently that they also created a whole group in the White House to address these very issues because it's happening, they said, way faster than any of us are imagining. Guys, this is going to be like the rug that they pull out from under us. One fell swoop. The dominant narrative going around today about Pew Research's new report on artificial intelligence and the future of jobs, which I haven't hit that one yet, but there is a hyperlink, is that experts can't really decide whether automation is going to make work obsolete. Says that it's really a toss-up whether robots will simply create new jobs in other sectors as they destroy old ones in others. That's true in one sense. The 1,896 futurists, CEOs, journalists, and university professors questioned for the report were split in half over robots will, quote, displace significant numbers of both blue and white-collar workers, with 52% of respondents agreeing that human ingenuity will create new jobs, industries, and ways to make a living, just as it has been doing since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution. But there's one major caveat. The respondents overwhelmingly agree that this lovely future where robots do the work and human beings design the robots and everyone has leisure time and lots of money only exists in a fantasy future where the school system pumps out a shitload of Elon Musks and Sergey Brins. Dang, that is true. And guess where they're doing that? Oh, China. Or at the very least, people who can reliably work at the companies that these guys own. The jobs that the robots will leave for humans will be those that require thought and knowledge. In other words, only the best educated humans will compete with machines, says Howard Reinhold, an internet sociologist, told Pew. I didn't know there were internet sociologists out there. Maybe that should be my new title. And education systems in the U.S. and much of the rest of the world are still sitting students in rows and columns, teaching them to keep quiet and memorize what is told to them, preparing them for a life in the 20th Century Factory, just like Pink Floyd showed us. In other words, if we continue down this path, we're on without finding a way to completely revamp the education system to turn the average student into exceptional ones that can outperform a robot. We'll look back on today's income inequality gap and think that it was a golden age for the middle class. If the education system doesn't change to start pumping out technologically savvy, creative people as a rule, not the exception, the rise of the robot worker is certain to lead an increase in income inequality and continued hollowing out of the middle class, even riots, social unrest, and the creation of a permanent, unemployable underclass, says the Pew Report. Wow, this is huge. You know, Pew, I've talked about those organizations that write big industry publications that you pay money for as an organization to get a future leg up on what the trends are in the industry. And Pew is one of those very well-renowned industry research publications that a lot of the financial industries look at, as well as many others. And guys, you hear what they're saying? Like, they're saying if we don't fix this right now, if we don't start pumping out lots and lots and lots of smart people who can compete with robots, we're going to have a permanent, unemployable underclass of population. What are they going to do with that? Oh, they're going to give us universal basic income. That's the solution, remember. And that'll fix it all. Just wave your hand and get your qubits. Anyway, back to the story. Yes, historically, technology has killed certain types of jobs while creating others, but what we're seeing happen right now isn't merely a redistribution of unskilled jobs to other sectors over the course of a couple decades or outsourcing of factory workers to other countries or cities with better tax breaks. Instead, it is wiping out entire industries, entire swaths of the economy in years, not decades. Now, we've talked time and time again about A, disruptive technologies, and B, the law of accelerating returns, both at play in that one sentence. And again, this is not happening to one industry. It's happening everywhere. That Davos forum, just in that little clip I played, they talked about there being many, many disruptive technologies that are all going to happen at the same time. And I think if there is ever a dystopia down the road, it's when they pull all those rugs. The world is going to be so upside down, topsy-turvy, we're not even going to know what time, anything. It's going to be like cognitive dissonance on steroids. And as long as they can medicate and placate the masses, dangle a carrot or two, give away some Happy Meals, Fitbits. You know, I got to tell you, let's take a break for 1 second. You know, we saw, did we look at that story? McDonald's was giving away Fitbits. Just like they're giving away that 3D goggle thing for the cell phone. You can make the fake 3D goggle, VR 3D goggles, you know, to kind of push it into the mainstream. They started giving away Fitbits as part of a Happy Meal. Like, what kind of a joke is that? But I saw, and that was just a few days ago, that was the 16th, I saw the story. There was a story that came out yesterday. McDonald's is now pulling the Fitbit trackers from their Happy Meals because the kids were getting rashes. Yes, they were getting rashes. So much for your Chinese manufacturing rubber or whatever they were. Some sort of, I don't know, they look like they're rubberized Fitbit thingies all in super day-glow colors. So anyway, no more Fitbits. So if you got one, sell it on eBay for $1 million. Make sure it's still in the package. Anyway, back to the story from Motherboard. Instead, it is wiping out entire industries, entire swaths of the economy, and in years, not decades, it is killing white-collar jobs as frequently as it is killing blue-collar ones. And as for the jobs created by the technology, it doesn't matter what color or what kind of collar you wear, because the people who can do those jobs are so highly sought after that they can wear whatever the hell they want. That's kind of a joke. I mean, because most of those people work from home. Justin Reich, a Harvard University fellow and his Berkman Center for Internet and Society, perhaps paint the clearest picture of this future. Quote, there will be a labor market in the service sector for non-routine tasks that can be performed interchangeably by just about anyone, and these will not pay a living wage. There will be some new opportunities created for complex non-routine work, but the gains at the top of this labor market will not be offset by the losses in the middle and the gains of terrible jobs at the bottom, he told Pew. The jobs that are left will be lower paying and less secure than those that exist now, and the middle is moving to the bottom. It's unbelievable, but that's what's going to happen. This is why the idea of, ding, the idea of the basic income, the universal basic income, is so appealing to many futurists, and why it might inevitably be necessary to keep everyone from starving. Can you believe they're talking about this in a mainstream publication? We've already seen the beginnings of what Reich is talking about, of course, and we've seen some of the strife that income inequality has caused. There's the chance, maybe the inevitability, that billions of people whose jobs stand to be automated will revolt. But if the status quo remains, technical skills won't be enough, and the only jobs that actually pay enough to live on will be highly skilled. And with a school system that is not churning out enough skilled workers, it is looking increasingly like the quote-unquote average people, at least until the education system is systematically and thoroughly reformed, could end up completely screwed. I mean, think about this. And then Pew releases a whole report on AI. Key themes, reasons to be hopeful. Advances in technology may displace certain types of work, but historically, there's been a net creator of jobs. Or so says you. Key themes to be concerned, impact from automation has thus far impacted blue-collar. The coming wave of innovation threatens to upend white-collar work as well, and that is all the artificial intelligence. Certain high-skilled workers will succeed wildly in this new environment, but far more may be displaced into lower-paying jobs, and our educational system is not keeping pace. Don't worry about it, because Ford now says it will have a fleet of fully autonomous cars in just 5 years. Count them five. Yeah, that's 2021, guys. Count them five. More than a century after introducing its Model T, Ford hopes that once again it will change how the masses move. The company announced this morning, and this was just a few days ago. This was the 16th, 3 days ago. That it will have thousands of fully autonomous vehicles in urban car sharing and ride hailing fleets by 2021. So remember I told you way back when, just push a big happy green button on your phone to hail your Google car, your Uber car, or now your Ford self-driving autonomous vehicle. To achieve that goal, the company will double to 300 the number of people at its Silicon Valley Research Center and add 60 autonomous fleets or vehicles to the fleet of already 30 it has deployed there. The five-year timeline isn't terribly aggressive. Google, Nissan, and Mercedes-Benz see autonomous vehicles on the road by 2020. And Chinese tech giant Baidu, that's the Google competitor, says it will have the technology by 2019. But none of them has made promises as specific as those fields made today for Ford. We see the upcoming decade for the automobile really centered around the automation of the automobile. Oh, the brain out a window. And now my second bastion of freedom, the car. Oh, I think we need to play Taps. Da-da-da. Da-da-da. This is so sad. Many automakers already offer limited automation in vehicles like the Tesla Model S and Model X, which I've had trouble, wink, and the Mercedes E-Class. And that one's a bit confusing, but Ford, like Google, wants nothing less than full autonomy. And I read the Ford one actually is not even going to have a steering wheel. Some of them are, but Ford will not. A designation the Society of American Engineers calls Level 4. That is full autonomy, Level 4. Field says the fleet in Silicon Valley won't even, here we go, have steering wheels or pedals. Oh my God. I don't think I could even deal with that. This would be just, oh, it's so frightening. It's so frightening to me. They could just take you anywhere. They could scan you with LIDAR inside. Bzzz, or whatever. They have LIDAR for steering and data. They could scan you. You have Li-Fi, too. And, you know, these cars are probably, I'm going to guess it, but think about, oh, I had it and it just disappeared. The one with Harrison Ford, and it was futuristic, and they were flying around, and everything was advertising. I think that inside these self-driving cars, that's how we're going to even pay for it. I mean, it might cost us a few qubits, but it'll be like partially sponsored by the ads that are running inside, but there'll be ads that beam into your head, right? We read about that a long, long time ago. And ones that'll be doing your brain scans, they can read what you're interested in and target market it. Of course, they'll tell you how they'll qualify the privacy policy. By using our vehicle, we'll be able to scan your brain for products and problems that you have so we could target market to you specifically for that personalized approach. Your chariot, madam. You know, like it could even, think about this, you put on the 3D goggles. Yeah, you know, this is just insanity, but like anything you imagine is possible now. Put on those 3D goggles and it will make the inside of the vehicle look like anything that you want it to look like. They'll scan your brain for all your fondest memories and you can pick one, like a picture display. Boop, bloop, bloop. Oh, that one. Christmas with Nana. You can hang out with Nana while you're traveling through the destroyed urban landscape where everything's dead. It'll be your own personal holodeck. I mean, guys, that really isn't too far out of the realm of possibility already with the technology we have today. They can use your eye movements to be able to control what's on the screen inside the goggles. I mean, how is that a stretch? Anyway, all right, I'm getting lost. Let's get back to the story. So Ford seems to have most of the pieces needed to do that. In July, it invested in Civil Maps, a Berkeley, California startup that makes software needed to turn LIDAR data into map robocars can read and automakers can update. And the automaker just invested heavily in a LIDAR manufacturer, Velodyne, in a bid to make the technology far more affordable. And the spinning bucket atop each Google car costs about $85,000. This is going to make it way, way. And I just saw DARPA had something with LIDAR. DARPA and some other company, they actually made it now as small as the width of a dime, believe it or not. And they signed an exclusive licensing deal with Nuremberg, listen to this, Neuroscience, to use that company's machine vision and deep learning technology. This is all for the Ford self-driving car. This is really crazy. Israeli startup DingSayUp will provide further help with their technology that helps robocars identify pedestrians, garbage cans, and the like. Like what? Certain people? Yeah. 230-point facial recognition, brain scans, like who knows? The big question is, who will run the fleet? GM has signed on with Lyft, while Uber is doing its own research, and Apple, which won't confirm it's developing a car, has invested $1 billion in the Chinese ride-sharing service Didi. Ford does not have a dance partner, but Field says, we have lots of options and we will talk with everyone. Fields won't say what the car might look like or where he might see them beyond the dense urban areas, but the commitment underscores how serious Ford is about autonomy. It fits very nicely with who we are as a company. He says autonomous vehicles could potentially have the same impact on society that Henry Ford's moving assembly line had. And the company that made the Model T ubiquitous wants to do the same with autonomous driving technology. Guys, it is coming. It is coming. And all of these driving machines are going to have deep learning capabilities and will be driving autonomous devices. Not that unlike a drone. Able to surveil with everything around them. The technologies all around you, and you will just be a node. You will be recognized the second you approach anything smart in the future. Now, here's a story that I ran across in IEEE Spectrum, NASA's Space Robotics Challenge, the test, the prizes, and how to participate. Last year at the DARPA Robotics Challenge, NASA announced a new challenge for humanoid robots called the Space Robotics Challenge, which will, quote, prepare robots for the journey to Mars. It's just like the DARPA Robotic Challenge. The first stage of the Space Robotics Challenge will consist of a virtual challenge run by a gazebo simulator, followed by a physical challenge using NASA's R5 Valkyrie robots. And we've seen those before. Valkyrie was the one that they had designed for moon missions. And they had talked about even, I thought, utilizing something very similar to this for that Office of Naval Research as well. They had a firefighting robot there. But now I guess they're modifying this robot a bit as of yesterday. And that was yesterday. No, 2 days ago, the 17th of August, NASA has opened registration for the Space Robotic Challenge, and we will take a look at the format of the competition, the challenges the team will need to compete with, and what they can take home for a winning. They are focusing on developing software to increase the autonomy of dexterous mobile robots, particularly those of humanoid format, so they can complete specific tasks during space travel or after landing on other planets such as Mars, as well as Earth. Ding, ding. These are humanoid robots, autonomous, very dexterous, to be used on Earth as well as Mars and other planets. Eventually, these robots will assist with such tasks as, one, deploying and preparing habitats, power systems, and other infrastructures on places such as Mars before humans arrive, or I'm thinking, yes, disaster relief and industrial plant maintenance on our own planet. Oh my God, FEMA's going to release the autonomous, dexterous humanoid robots to help us rebuild after a disaster. Are you hearing what I'm reading? That's what this is saying. Following the virtual challenge scenario serves as a backdrop for developing coding advancements that enable the autonomy of humanoid robotics. Autonomous humanoid robotics, I repeat. In the not too distant future, look, they even used my term, the R5 Valkyrie robot has arrived on Mars along with supplies ahead of a human mission. Overnight, a dust storm damages the habitat and solar array and causes the primary communication antenna to be misaligned. The R5 must now repair an air leak in the habitat, deploy a new solar panel, and align the communications antenna. Sounds like fun, right? Yes, right. So that's the challenge. Anyone can enter the challenge, although the team leader of each team must be a U.S. citizen. And in order to win a prize for NASA to give you taxpayer money, in other words, 51% of the team must be U.S. citizens, although if you're a student at a U.S. university, that does count. Sounds like foreign teams can still enter and compete to win. You just won't get any prize money for doing so. But before the challenge itself, there is a qualification round. Simulated R5 will have to identify patterns of colored light blinking and blah, 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 push a button, whatever. Let's see how much they're offering. The top four teams will be awarded a code implementation partnership with an R5 host team for a time period of at least 2 weeks. We're assuming this means that if you prove that you know what you're doing in the virtual challenge, NASA will let you try your software out on one of the handful of real Valkyrie robots in the lab in the United States and Europe, and the winner will get $125,000, with $100,000 going to second place, $50,000 to third place, and $25,000 to fourth. Additionally, as many as six teams can take home a $50,000 bonus for competing in all 18 subtests consecutively within one single perfect run. And registration for the challenge is now open and remains open until September 16th. So there you go, guys. New FEMA robots that are autonomous, dexterous, and humanoid in shape. That might look a little like something like Valkyrie. You could spell it, put it in right now into Google, V-A-L-K-Y-R-I-E, to help us rebuild after disaster. But you know, that's just the beginning. Remember, this is all just the beginning. So, story comes out in Big Think from last week. Because you know the inevitable future are humanoid robots with human-like skin, deep learning, and artificial intelligence that are probably more human than some humans we know. The inevitable is going to happen. Can you fall in love with a robot for a Friday for UCY's 4th anniversary? We're going to ask the big question. It's for you, Jax. And all you people who wait around for robot babes. Advances in robotics and AI are starting to gain some real momentum. And in the coming decades, scientists predict robots will take over more and more jobs, including white-collar ones, and gain ubiquity in the home, Jibo, school, and work spheres. Due to this, roboticists and AI experts, social scientists, psychologists, and others are speculating what impact it will have on us and on our world. Google and Oxford have teamed up to make a kill switch that should initiate a robot apocalypse, so they say. One way to overcome this is to imbue AI with emotions and empathy. And you know, we just talked about Sophia not wanting to kill humans anymore. And the Davos 2016 conference, that Indian guy talking about how, being remote, we need to have empathy. Because we could be either the Jedi or the Sith with this technology. And now they're saying the way to overcome robot apocalypse is, yes, to give robots and AI emotions and empathy. They're already talking about giving them feelings to allow them to sense and to be hurt. Why not give them empathy? To make them as human as possible, so much so that it may become difficult to tell robots apart from real people. In this vein, scientists have wondered if it might be possible for a human to fall in love with a robot, considering we are moving toward fashioning them after our own image. Yes. With all the synthetic biology, people, and creating of the synthetic human genome, and crossing those lines between biology and created biology in the vision of man, we are crossing some thresholds here that are nothing short of apocalyptic, revolutionary, and it's a complete, utter turning of everything we know on its head. What would happen if we had biological, synthetic, robotic life living amongst us, interacting with rights? I mean, we've looked at the ethics of robot rights. And as they become cognizant, and I have a story about consciousness that I think we're going to have to touch on Monday. They actually found where that exists now, they say. Recent studies have found that humans can feel concern over a robot if they think that it's in pain. How interesting then that they're going to imbue robots with pains. This indicates that we can feel as much empathy for a mechanical person as even a biological one. Remember, we read a story, too, that they showed people in a panel. I don't know who signed up for this study. The naughty bits on a computer, and people actually got aroused. So, of course, emotional concern is not the same as romantic love. The thought of humans interacting with robots on a complex emotional level was first tested back in 1966. And back then, MIT professor Joel Weizenbaum created a computer called ELIZA, who took the role of a psychologist and asked the participant therapy-like questions to see how they would respond and interact with the program. And people soon began treating ELIZA like it were a living, breathing person. Though not advanced as AI today, it did elicit in-depth responses. In fact, Weizenbaum soon found that subjects were more comfortable revealing intimate details to the program than they were to most people. Perhaps they did knowing so because ELIZA wouldn't judge. And there are indications that falling for a robot is possible. For instance, research shows that people who chit-chat via email, messenger, on the phone, or through text often feel a more intimate bond to those than those that they chit-chat with in face. The pressure is off, and so might too be with a robot. So I don't know, guys. What about the stigmatization? Would a human-robot relationship be deemed as worthy as a human-to-human one, or would it be kept keeping a robot lover be considered unable to find or attract a real person? Another aspect is what human-robot relationships would do to the organic variety. Why would someone who never loads the dishwasher, forgets your birthday, and hates your friends when you could have a robot who wouldn't ever? This is insane. To see where we are, let's take a look at Sophia. And that's where they kind of left it. All right, guys, well, make sure you stick around. There's all kinds of radio here for a Friday. Up next, Lonnie Clark. And after that, it is Friday, so we have Josh live at 6 p.m. Eastern. This week's primer time at 8. Truth on the Tracks with Brandon Turville at 9, Cutting Through the Matrix with Almont at 10, and Anti-Media Radio with Levon at 11. All right, guys, make sure you listen this weekend for more awesome radio, and I will catch up with you on Monday. Everybody take care. Listening to UCY.com.